Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. If this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, you can all do me a big favor. Please check out some of our past shows at AnswersForTheFamily.com to hear some incredibly informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts as they discuss ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group or someone you know that can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, speaking of making a positive difference, the question that is now on everybody's lips is, where in the world is Gabriella? Gabriella, where are you now?
I am in the Provence, between Saint-Rémy-de-Provence and Les Baux in France.
Wow. All right. So
you didn't expect that, did you?
No, I didn't. And I was sitting here thinking, you know, I did take 1 year of French, but I don't think I'm going to catch all of this.
Saint-Rémy is a pretty known place for either retirees of Europeans. It's like the California or the it's where Vincent van Gogh cut off his ear. And my father happens to live here. He did not cut off his ear.
Good thing.
Somebody gets ideas here. But I have an ailing father of 90, and I was in Paris last week, and I came here to give him a hint. Mm. You know, 90 is quite the age, and this is, if I do it for a lot of strangers, I can also do it for my dad, right? It just, for my dad, happens to be a little bit farther out of the way, usually.
Well, for those new listeners, share with us a little bit about what your journey is right now as you continue along the Dare to Be Kind movement.
So as a kindness expert, we started the Dare to Be Kind movement, and we have three specific things that we do. So the first thing that we ask people is not to reinvent the wheel, but within a 2 mile radius of wherever you are, doesn't matter where you hang your shingle, like me at the moment I'm here, what can you do in a 2 mile radius to help someone else? And when I say that, this never, ever has actually anything to do with money. It really has about giving your time. And what is very important for people to understand, you have to see it first. You know, if we have our noses in all the devices, we cannot see if kindness or compassion or empathy is needed, or even just a smile or a little hug. Those things can only be seen if we're present. So that's one. And the second one is really fun, is we're asking people to not be an author or anything, but we're asking people to send in by audio, by video, or in written language, or even just phone me, and I will ask them questions, and I will pull out that beautiful, ugly, I always say ugly, beautiful, or sad story, because in all of our stories, there's somewhere that little, there is somewhere that beautiful little piece that another human being at the other side of the world really wants to hear, and it makes them not feel alone. And the third part is one that Alan is a big fan of, is I'm creating a Dare to Be Kind TV show. So I'm interviewing people like, for example, first responders, teachers, 911 operators, people that are doing incredible good that we actually don't know what they do. Mm-hmm. We really don't know. Yeah, it's kind of, And what is really interesting is that I do it from the perspective of different age groups. So, for example, the young crowd under 18, the millennials, and then everyone above 35. And so that gives us a better aspect of who thinks where the solution should be. And I think that would be really wonderful to bring to the market.
Well, Gabriella, I have someone to nominate, and she's sitting right here next to me that I think would be an incredible guest on your show.
Okay.
You know, and I'm sure as you listen to the show, you'll learn more about her as well. But before I introduce her, I just really want to thank you. And just to let everybody know, I mean, think about someone who is out there who pulled up roots and dedicated 2 years to travel around the world. Yep. And just bring kindness. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. So I just really want to acknowledge and thank you for taking up that incredible challenge.
Thank you so much, Alan. And Kelly, come and find me on social media. It's really easy. Just find Dare to Be Kind. Don't try to find my Dutch last name. But Dare to Be Kind and you should find me. Okay?
I will.
And have an awesome show together. And I'm going to prepare dinner for my dad, because it's 7 o'clock at night and he's looking at me. He's hungry.
All right. Well, enjoy.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So now to tell everybody a little bit about my guest co-host today, it is Kelly Galindo. Kelly is an American actress, director, and producer, and her work has spanned decades in television, theater, and film. She is currently directing 26 Seconds, which is a documentary miniseries that is giving a voice to children who are victims of the sex trade. Now, for the past 3 years, Kelly has traveled around the world to expose the horrific exploitation that continues to happen in our world today. In this film, Kelly also highlights the nonprofit organizations that have actively stepped forward to do something about it. Kelly balances her directing and acting career by passing on her craft onto future generations of students as a professor at the Dodge College of Film and Media Arts at Chapman University. She has taught at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, as well as the Orange County School of Arts. Kelly is a lifetime member of the Actor Studio as both an actor and a director. Before we get to our guest, Kelly, let's start a little bit with just why you decided to make this film, because I know it's a pressing issue as someone who's been one of the kind of boots on the ground people in this area. But my question is, why were you willing to put years into making this specific documentary?
Oh, well, first of all, Alan, I being a professor at Chapman University, I knew that I had the luxury of being able and blessing to be able to use the equipment and be able to, take up some of the cost that it right. takes to do a project. And because of that, I didn't want to do a project on anything that didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do a project on something that mattered, because I know from my background in directing theater that a project takes 3 to 5 years of your life, from pre-production, production, and post-production, and depending on the success of the project, you know, because then it, mm-hmm. it can expand. So it has to be something that you're passionate about, that matters, and that there, and most of all, that there's a higher calling, that it's not about me, and so that, because there's days that you want to quit because it's hard.
Sure.
And but there's something bigger that keeps you going, which is these children. And it's also women. So the project originally, though, started, I it was just put on my heart by God, and I said, okay. And I reached out to Destiny Rescue, an organization that I knew about through a friend. And I got a meeting with them and asked if I could go on one of their team trips so I could start finding out about it. So it was a long process to get approved, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally did it. And so that was my first trip. And originally I was going to do a short documentary on sex tourism in Thailand because of the fact that Westerners, Europeans, Australians go there specifically to be able to get away with being a pedophiler. It just made me sick.
Mm-hmm.
Just made me sick. So when I got there, though, I realized that this was a much bigger issue. And then, so I decided, okay, I need to, because Destiny Rescue was also in Cambodia, Philippines, Laos, Dominican Republic, and India. So I knew it was a much bigger issue. So I wanted to then expand it to a 2-hour feature documentary. So what happens with God is he has much bigger plans than we do. I only can see, you know, an inch in front of me, and he sees the big picture. So, and he also, I think, waits to see our, you know, God's into changing people's character and seeing their faith. So I think God, I feel privileged that he has continued to want me on his project, because I think it's God's project. But, you know, of course, if God saw that I wasn't faithful or didn't have the same heart as him, then he gives the project to someone else to do, because it will get done. God mm-hmm. will make sure it's done, right? So it's a privilege that he's trusting me. So after Thailand and Cambodia, then I decided to shoot. Then I had an opportunity. I met Pastor Kevin Brown, who's amazing. He does great work in Orange County called Harbor Outreach, because trafficking is right here in the U.S. But he was going to Iraq. At that time, he was doing work because there was a huge crisis, as mm-hmm. you know, in 2016, where ISIS was abducting Yazidi and Christian girls. It was horrific. So I went with, so Pastor Kevin thankfully took me with him. So I shot in Iraq. And I want you to know too, this project probably could have taken less time, except that I teach. So I was only shooting in the summertime and also in the winter during my breaks. So, so then the following summer I shot in India. The following winter, I shot at the Super Bowl in Minneapolis, because trafficking is huge. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that's yeah. And one of the things that a lot of, especially a lot of Americans or Westerners don't realize is that the largest trafficking event in the world is our own Super Bowl. And people fly in other people, you know, for their own exploitation. You know, I want to tell everybody out there is that you know, one of the great things is Kelly's going to be back on May 20th, and we're going to be able to go in incredibly deep into all of this stuff. But we wanted to touch on it a little bit so that everybody would know just enough to be able to, number one, come back and listen, but also to gain more information if they need to by either getting in contact with you or going to the website. But where are you now in production? Because I know that you also have something now on Amazon Prime. Yeah. So tell us where you're at in production.
So I wrapped it this mm-hmm. past summer in East Africa. So all of the countries combined now are Thailand, Cambodia, Iraq, India, East Africa, Mexico, and the U.S., right? So three years of, but we finally wrapped production this past summer in August, and now I'm viewing footage and taking notes. But I Amazon Prime, currently the pilot is right. available on Amazon Prime and soon to be available on iTunes and Google Play. And I'm going to be following up with 6 to 8 episodes from each country. So the project went from a short mm-hmm. documentary to a 2-hour documentary to now a 6 to 8 episodic miniseries, because I just couldn't finish it. I had too much footage, too much information, too many countries, too many survivors.
Well, and I understand, because again, it's a much bigger problem than most people mm-hmm. realize. And once you got into it and you started to see how much is really out there, I can certainly see that mm-hmm. that you needed to keep going. So what can people do to help? So, you know,
Yes, please.
What can people do to help? Because that's part of what we want to bring with this show is that it's a matter of, you know, we all want to make a positive difference in the mm-hmm. lives of others. So that, you know, for some people, you know, that are working 12, 16 hours a day, you know, it may not be that they have time, but maybe they have money, or people that are, you know, that may not have money, but they have time. Mm-hmm. What are the things that they can do to make a difference? Because I think it's something that we all want to do.
So my goal, obviously, is to create awareness and a call to action. And you're absolutely right. Everyone has different gifts, and we're at different times mm-hmm. in our lives when we have time and don't have time, or have money and don't have money. So how you can help our project is you can log on to our website, 26 seconds with an S, so plural, 20 the number 26, and then seconds lowercase, docfordocumentary.com. So 26 seconds, secondsdoc.com. So log on to the website. You can view the project, what's going on. But please, you can either, if God's leading you to donate, either there's a donate button that takes you to our website, Network for Good, and also on the, and these are both on the homepage at the bottom of the page. And or please go on, you can log on to the Amazon Prime link, and it will take you to the Amazon Prime. And please view the pilot and leave your rating. Because they keep you, either high on the homepage, bumped up, or you get bumped down. So if you view it and rate it, then we can keep spreading awareness and creating a call to action.
Yeah, which is a great point. And you know, for those that aren't aware of that, and I'm just learning about this even as it relates to this show, if you like something, and if you take that extra minute or two, and you express the fact that you like it, you're benefiting that, whatever that project is, you're benefiting this show, you're benefiting that documentary by being able to keep it high in the ratings, which means more people see it. If more people see it, there's more exposure. And that's what we're trying to do, is to get information out there. So I'm glad that you brought that up as something that they can do. So that everybody will stay till the end of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about a new film festival that Kelly's involved in, but we're going to talk about that after our guests. So stay with us, and we will go into that. Well, now we're going to talk about something that is huge in America, and there's no pun in saying that. But if you struggle with binge eating, emotional eating, stress eating, or you repeatedly manage to lose weight and you go on this yo-yo thing and then all of a sudden you gain it back again, it may be something that you're approaching things with just the wrong mindset. Now, our guest today, Glenn Livingston, is a PhD, is a veteran psychologist, and he was a longtime CEO of a multi-million-dollar consulting firm which serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. Now, you may have seen his or his company's previous work or their theories and research in many major periodicals like the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and many other major media outlets. You may have also heard him on ABC, WGN, CBS Radio, or UPN TV. He's been out there spreading the word, which is again what we're talking about here, is how do we get information out to people to make a positive difference. But what he was disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer food-obsessed individuals. So Dr. Livingston spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via work with his own patients and a self-funded research project with more than 40,000 participants. Now, if you can put that together, 40,000 participants, I've met people or looked into other things, and I'll ask, well, what are you basing your information on? And they'll say, I just talked to somebody. They said, well, we tested 120 people. Okay, we're talking 40,000 now. So, that's really putting your time in. So, but most important, however, was the his own personal journey out of obesity and food prison to a normal, healthy weight and a much more lighthearted relationship with food. So Glenn, let's kind of go right into the point of, why is, overeating, stress-related eating, binge eating, why is it now so prevalent in our culture today?
I think there's several reasons. I think that the big food industry is engineering and getting progressively better at it, these hyper-palatable food-like substances, concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and excitotoxins. And it's all packaged up to look healthy. I remember speaking with a VP at a major food bar manufacturer who told me that they took the vitamins out of the bar because they were too expensive and making it taste worse, and put the money into the packaging instead to make it look healthy. And that was their biggest profitable insight. And I don't mean to single them out, because that kind of stuff goes on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these food-like substances are designed to hit our bliss point. The billions of dollars that go into this, to hit our bliss point without giving us the nutrition to make us feel satisfied. And so the result is we want more. And what you might say is that our evolutionary pleasure mechanism has been short-circuited. An animal analogy might be studies in which electrodes were placed in the brains of mammals, starting with rats, then going on to monkeys and higher animals, I think even humans. Started with Milner and Olds back in the 50s and 60s. And what they did is they put an electrode in the pleasure center of the brain, and they allowed the rats to start with to push a button to self-stimulate the pleasure center as often as they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they pushed it thousands of times per day to the exclusion of their survival needs. So a starving rat would just push the button thousands of times a day and ignore its food. Nursing mother rat would ignore her pups to press the button thousands of times a day. I'm sorry about the noise in the background. They seem to have started a construction project outside. And rats would crawl over these painful electrical grids to get to it. So what happened there? The survival drive was more or less hijacked to this artificial short-circuited method for experiencing pleasure in a way that nature didn't intend. And I'm not paranoid. I don't think anybody's putting electrodes in our brains or kidnapping us at night or anything like that. But I do think that if you could walk out of McDonald's and see a Burger King across the street in most cities these days, that it says something about the kind of chemical electrodes that we're being exposed to and all the pleasure buttons that we're being given. And you combine that with the fact that people don't like fruit and vegetables much anymore, and you can see why things are so powerful. And then you add the big addiction treatment industry that says that you can't quit even if you want to. The best you could do is abstain one day at a time. And there's really no evidence of that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So those three things, I think, create the perfect storm to make overeating, binge eating, even just going way beyond your own best judgment, to be rampant, an epidemic today.
Well, in the introduction, I mentioned that you had your own battle that you fought. So let's share a little bit about how that makes you more uniquely qualified to talk about this subject and how you beat it yourself.
Painfully. That's how I did it. it took me 30 years to figure it out. I come from a family of psychologists, so I really thought the answer would be in what's eating me, as opposed to a more very practical, rational solution. But when I was 17, I figured out that if I worked out for 2 or 3 hours a day, I could eat whatever I wanted to. I'm 6'4", I'm pretty muscular. And so, you know, 6,000-8,000 calories a day, no big deal. Boxes of muffins, boxes of chocolate, boxes of pizza, whatever I wanted. And I thought it was great. I did not think it was a problem. I thought it was the best thing I ever discovered. But when I got a little older and I was married and I had patients and a 2-hour commute each way and all these responsibilities, I just couldn't work out like that. I could barely work out for, you know, an hour once a week. So I kept eating like that because I found that the foods had a life of their own, and I got fatter and fatter. And I, more importantly, couldn't really concentrate. I couldn't be present at work. And that's very important for a psychologist, because psychology is not so much about having an intellectual answer for things, although, you know, training and education is important. It's more about being able to lend people your soul so they love and trust you enough to think new thoughts and take risks and live in a different way. And I was working with very high-risk people. I was working with suicidal adolescents, and I was working with couples right after an affair. And I couldn't be 100% present because I was sitting and thinking about when I could get the next pizza, and that really, really bothered me. I'm from a family of 17 psychologists, and it was a very strong value in my mind to be the best psychologist I could. So I went on a journey, and I went to the best doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous for a lot of years and even did that lung study. And it was a very soulful journey where I understood a lot about what was eating me and where the holes were in my heart. And I don't think I'd be the person I am today if I hadn't done that, so I don't regret it. But I found that it was, in the end, really just sidetracking me from what I needed to do to overcome this. And I'll tell you a story to illustrate it. When I was finishing up that study, with the 40,000 people, which was done over the course of 5 years online when clicks were really, really cheap, by the way, but still I got 40,000 people to take a survey. And I asked them, what foods did they struggle to stop eating once they started? And what were they feeling stressed about in their life? What I found were three very interesting things. One was that people who struggled with chocolate, like me, my binges always started with chocolate. They ended with, you know, pizza and muffins and everything else, but they always started with chocolate. What did people like me suffer with? And it turned out that they tended to be lonely or brokenhearted. And that makes sense because I was in a bad marriage and, you know, I was very frustrated and I was feeling lonely and brokenhearted. The people who struggled with salty, crunchy things, like pretzels and chips, they tended to be stressed at work. And the people who struggled with soft, chewy things, like bagels and bread or pasta, they tended to be stressed at home. And I thought this was really fascinating. And like you said, there were 40,000 people, so I thought this should be substantial. And I went to, before I started working with patients, and originally I did not work with anyone that had an eating disorder because I had one myself, and I didn't think it was ethical. So I would refer them, I might work with them at the same time as a specialist was working with them, but I'd always refer them to a specialist. So I went to my mom and I said, Mom, you know, I have a study and it says that people who love chocolate like us, we tend to be lonely or brokenhearted. And I reminded her about the marriage and I said, that makes sense, but there's got to be a reason why this pattern got set up. And, you know, you're a therapist and you were there. What is it? What could possibly have happened? And she gets this awful look in her face and this awful sound in her voice. And she says, I'm so sorry. And I said, Mom, what is it? She says, I'm so sorry. I said, Mom, whatever it is, I forgive you. It's 40 years ago. I'm just trying to figure it out. It's okay, Mom. I love you. And so she tells me that in 1965, when I was about one, that my father was a captain in Vietnam, and he was a captain in the Army, and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And she was really terrified that she was going to be a single mother. She was trying to get pregnant. There was going to be another one on the way, and she was really terrified she was going to be a single mom. At the same time, her father, my grandfather, had just gotten out of prison. And that was devastating to her because he was guilty and she didn't know it and she'd idolized him her whole life. And so most of the time, she was feeling very depressed and anxious. And she apparently would just be sitting and staring at the wall. And I'd come running to her to be fed or get loved or, you know, the things that a one-year-old kid might do. And she didn't have the wherewithal to do it all the time. So she kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in the refrigerator on the floor. And she said, Glenn, go get your Bosco. And I'd go crawling over to the refrigerator and I'd take out the Bosco and I'd suck on the bottle and I'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. And if this were the movies, at this point, Mom and I would have a great big hug and a great big cry. And we'd forgive each other and I'd forgive myself and I'd never have trouble with chocolate again. If it really was that hole in my heart, then that should have fixed it. It didn't. It actually made it worse. And the reason it got worse was because there was this voice in my head that started talking a little more loudly. It started to say, hey, Glenn, you know what? You're right. Our mama didn't love us enough, and she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in our heart. And until we can find the love of our life and get out of this, you know, horrible marriage, then you're going to have to go right on binging on chocolate. Let's go get some now, okay? And what I learned from that was that there was this voice of justification that was doing most of the damage. It didn't necessarily matter what emotion I had, because if you think about it, it's okay to have any emotion. Suppose you thought of an emotion like the fire. Well, a fire, a roaring fire in a well-contained fireplace can be the center of hearth and home. It's where memories are made. It's where people gather around and talk and feel comforted. The center of hearth and home. But only if there's a good enough fireplace. If there's a hole in the fireplace, then sparks can get out and the house can burn down. And I decided that what was happening was that there was this irrational voice that was poking holes in the fireplace. And that what I needed to do was learn to contend with that irrational voice much more so than having to fix the emotion. And that it would be quicker. And I knew as a psychotherapist that it could take years to teach people to deal with the emotions or to tamp down the emotions. But that a lot of the cognitive, behavioral, rational stuff could be done a lot more quickly. And so this is a little embarrassing. It was actually in concert with learning more about the neurology of addiction. I learned that the part of our brain that responds to food addiction, all these hyperpalatable substances, it's a lizard brain, the reptilian brain, the most primitive part of our anatomy. And when the lizard brain sees something in the environment, it doesn't know love. It only knows, do I eat it, do I mate with it, or do I kill it? Eat, mate, or kill. It's very primitive. It's the mammalian brain. It's the higher brain. And then the neocortex, which has concern for tribe and loved ones and family and long-term goals and aspirations and societal contribution and giving back and being kind. And I have a tattoo on my left arm that says be kind, by the way. and it's the lizard brain doesn't know love. And so it didn't make sense all these years that I was trying to love myself out of the addiction, because the part of the brain that knows the addiction doesn't know love. So I said, well, what's the alternative? And the alternative is more like an alpha wolf deal with a challenger for leadership. And when another member of the pack challenges the alpha wolf for leadership, it doesn't say, oh my God, someone needs a hug. It says, get back in line or I'll kill you. It snarls and growls. And if the other member of the pack doesn't get back in line, there's going to be a fight, maybe to the death. So I said, this is more like capturing and caging a rabid animal than loving my inner wounded child back to health. All that psychological work I did was great, but to get this under control, it's going to be more like, controlling the biological urges that are generated by my bladder or even my testicles, where they generate a powerful urge, but they don't control me. If I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of a business meeting, I don't just drop trow and go. I say, well, no, I got to do this in a particular time in a particular place, and I'll excuse myself or I'll wait until after the meeting, and I'll do that because I'm a respectable member of society. Just like if I see an attractive woman in the street, I don't go run up and kiss her. I might want to talk to her, but I won't run up and kiss her because I'll behave respectably. So, because it's under my control. I live comfortably with those urges because I know that my human brain is superior to my bladder or my testicles. And it might sound a little crude, but that's really what's going on. So here's the embarrassing part. This is how I fixed it for myself, and it wasn't immediate, but this is where the turnaround came. I decided that my inner lizard brain, my inner reptilian brain, was going to be my pig. I never intended to publish this. It was an unfortunate metaphor. I just kept a journal, and I decided it was going to be my pig. I decided to draw very clear, bright lines because that separated healthy from unhealthy eating, because I knew from my research into willpower that willpower was worn down by decision-making, so the more decisions I could make up front, the better. And then I would be able to hear the voice of my pig, which I called my pig squealing. And the moment that I heard it squealing for something I wasn't supposed to have, like, for example, I would make a rule that said, I will never eat chocolate Monday through Friday again. If it was craving chocolate on a Wednesday and it said, gee, you worked out hard enough, or you won't really gain any weight, or you have plenty of hours before you go to sleep, you can deal with this, or maybe chocolate comes from a cocoa bean which grows in a plant and therefore it's a vegetable. Whatever it was, I say, I'm glad that Kelly likes my sense of humor. I would say, I don't want that, my pig does. My pig is squealing for its slop. I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. After decades of suffering, that's what finally started to give me those extra microseconds at the moment of impulse to wake up and remember who I was and how I wanted to behave around a particular food. And it wasn't a miracle. I mean, the miracle was that I no longer felt powerless and no longer felt like there was a mysterious disease or crazy force inside me. But I realized that it was me making the decisions. And eventually, when I realized that nobody was telling me what to eat and I could make any food rule I wanted to, I didn't have to stop eating chocolate if I didn't want to, didn't have to restrict it at all if I didn't want to, it was totally up to me. I realized that what was fixing things was the ability to move my food decisions from my emotions to my intellect. And so I just decided that I was going to make rules and follow them. And I could change the rules if I wanted to, but there was no point to breaking them because it was my decision and I had free will. And now I could do it by just saying, I don't want that, my pig does. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And that's a slightly embarrassing story. It eventually, I was not going to publish it, but I was a minor partner in a publishing company when I was getting divorced. And my business partner, the CEO, said, we need to publish a book to prove that we know what we're doing. And I said, well, I have this cockamamie journal that really helped me a lot. Maybe it would help other people. And he said, let me read it. And he read it. I think I edited it a little bit into the book first. He read it. He started an 86-pound weight loss journey of his own. And then before you knew it, we'd published it, and it took off. And we have 600,000 readers and almost 2,000 reviews on Amazon. And every day I got emails from people that say, oh, my God, I have my life back. I don't need pig slop. I don't look for a man. We'll tell me what to do.
All right. The book is called Never Binge Again. We are talking with the author, Glenn Livingston. We're going to take a break. Stay with us. And if those of you that would like to go to the website, if you want to follow along with us, obviously don't do this if you're driving, but you can open up another window on your computer, go to neverbingeagain.com. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about willpower and social pressure. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. So we are talking to Glenn Livingston, and the book is called Never Binge Again. And when we left, Glenn had mentioned a little bit in regards to willpower and such. And my guest co-host, Kelly Galindo, you have a question for him in regards to willpower.
I do. First of all, nice to meet you, Glenn.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah, and I want to bring up, when I was reading the notes, and I think this is interesting, I had no idea you were a man. I thought Glenn was a woman. That's because my brain goes there, like, oh, women have overeating issues, right? So I think it's really phenomenal and interesting and brave of you, because of course men have eating issues too. but I think I think most people right away think it's more of a woman issue. So, thank you. And but I wanted to ask you about willpower a little bit, because you also talked about how, because you're, you know, very intelligent as a psychologist, and you're very in tune to, you know, what the brain tells you and character tells you and willpower. And so I just wanted to know, what was the, what did you mean, you know, the difference between willpower and character?
Oh, well, that's actually a very important question. And originally, I thought the book would only be for men, by the way. I even put a big for men only star on it. And then 95% of our clients turned out to be women, so.
Yeah, see? I was right.
I had to take out the star. So willpower is, it's not a black and white thing. It's more like gas you have in the tank, and it's fatigued by decision making. And if you say that you'll have chocolate 90% of the time and avoid it 10% of the time, that might be a good guideline, but you don't really know which is the 10% and which is the 90%. So every time you're at Starbucks and there's a chocolate bar at the counter, you have to make another decision and use your willpower. On the other hand, if you say, I will only have the last 3 days of the calendar month, then you've created the same impact, but 90% of the time your decisions have been made, because, you know, 27 out of 30 days you're not eating chocolate. What you're really saying when you do that is, I've made a decision to become the kind of person that doesn't eat chocolate for the vast majority of the month. That's what you're really doing. And character trumps willpower because the decisions have been made. Imagine that. So we build character like this all the time. We just don't know it. So if you go into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table, and the waitress says, I'll be right back because I just have to get your menus. And there are no windows. There's nobody up front. Nobody would see you take it. Kelly, would you take that $20 bill?
I wouldn't, but when I was young, I probably would have.
What's the difference? What's the difference? What happened? What changed?
I'm more mature now, you know, and I think of others. I think when you're young, you're thinking about yourself and what you can get away with. And when you're older, you know, there's a shift in life. It should be. There should be.
Because that woman worked hard for her money, and you're not a thief. You've got an unwritten rule that says, I never steal. And that's a rule of character.
Yeah.
It's just character.
That's something
you
develop, yeah. Well, that rule eliminates the need to use willpower in that situation. It's just become part and parcel of who you are. It's not even an option. And for most people, it's not an option. Most people have gone through a similar transformation. Some people say, you're damn right, I'll take it. But I don't really want those people in my house. And so what I'm advocating really is, as a defense against the onslaught of money and engineering and chemicals that are, you know, being put into all these bags and boxes and containers that make everybody look for love at the bottom of them, that we decide what type of people we want to be around our trouble foods. And it's interesting, because if you ask people, could you give up chocolate entirely? They'll say, no, I could never do that. But if you say, could you become the kind of person who doesn't eat chocolate? They'll say, well, maybe. Because intuitively we know that we have the wiring to do that kind of thing. And it turns out that the place where we develop character in the brain, it's more of the mammalian brain and the upper brain, not the lizard brain. And we know that that part of the brain is superior. It's wired to be superior. Whether it evolved like that, whether God put it there, it's superior to the lizard brain. And so we have the ability to do that. We can remake ourselves. We can decide the kind of person that we want to be regardless of who we were in the past. It doesn't matter if you've failed a million times before. As a matter of fact, the research on people who lose weight permanently as compared to people who yo-yo diet shows that one of the biggest distinctions between them is that the people who lose weight permanently have many more attempts behind them. So if your listeners are
falling down and getting up and falling down and getting up and falling down and getting up, they're doing the right thing. And if their pigs are telling them, you know, you're pathetic, you might as well give up, you're never going to get this, well, that's the wrong thing. That's the wrong thing. So, you know, deciding to stay in the game until you win the game, deciding to articulate exactly what your relationship with food is going to be, you know, that's character. That's building character, and that's what eliminates willpower, and that's really what I find helps people to overcome overeating when nothing else has.
I have a question for you, because, and I never even realized this until listening to you right now, and it's fascinating. But I just, because I'm trying to think, okay, because when I don't know why, but when you brought up in Starbucks, I thought, okay, because I never think of, okay, should I do this, or I don't want to do this, I just had this epiphany right now, but I actually, and it's why I've gained weight over the years, because I was like you, when you're younger, you can eat what you want, and you don't gain weight, right? But my, and the question I'm going to ask, is this willpower, or is this character? But I just had a complete epiphany right now. But what I do is I eat what I want, because I don't want no one telling me what to do.
Nobody wants people to tell me.
So is that willpower or character? Because now, again, when I was younger, I stayed thin because you could eat what you want. But now I still have that little brat attitude. I'm going to eat what I want. It's not even a thing of 90 or 10% or what I choose. I'm going to eat what I want when I want. So what is that?
Well, a lot of people struggle with any rules whatsoever because they feel like someone is telling them what to do. What I tell people is that you actually wind up being a slave to your impulses, and you're letting these big companies tell you what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, every time you eat one of those bags or boxes or containers, there's some fat cat with a mustache and a white suit that's laughing all the way to the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people is that it's kind of like driving. You know, we need some lights. We need some red lights. We need some stop signs. If you didn't have any red lights in New York City, nobody could go anywhere. It's just too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And in your own behavioral economy around food, you can decide where those dangerous intersections are. And you can decide where you don't need any lights whatsoever. And the idea is to come up with the minimum protections that help you accomplish your health and fitness goals. So you don't want to create rules that overly restrict you. You don't want to create rules that prevent you from enjoying your food. But you just, if there's some place you're getting in trouble, then you need to do something. So maybe it's just a rule that supports mindfulness. Like, I always put my fork down between bites, or I never eat in front of the TV or something like that. But people need to do something to articulate at least where the target is, even if they're going to miss the target.
And Glenn, we have a listener question that sort of ties into this a little bit, and this one comes in from a listener that says, I have struggled my entire life with night binging. During the day, I'm just fine, but around 8 or 9 p.m., even if I've already had a nice dinner, I just need something more, and celery sticks just don't cut it. I've tried diet supplements, hypnotherapy, you know, I read a stack of books thinking that it might be tied to my anxiety or some other emotional issue. Please explain why your book and method might help me. I'm ready to buy it now if there's a solution in sight. And this says, thanks from Alice in Minnesota.
Well, Alice, you don't have to buy the book because it's free in Kindle Nook or PDF format. You can get that at Never Binge Again. But thank you for your enthusiasm and excellent question. People that struggle at night have usually worn down their willpower during the day. And so, and there are a couple of ways that you can prevent that. And then one of the most important things you can do is try to make your food decisions in the morning. So if this happens to you night after night, then get some Tupperware, set out your dinner, make sure it's substantial, make sure it's something you're going to be looking forward to, make sure that, you know, it's limited in some way so you're not going to be sacrificing your health and fitness goals. And have it all ready and waiting for you all day long so you know that you can look forward to that. That's one thing. The second thing is I always have people tell me that they take good enough care of themselves during the day. And whenever they tell me the story about eating at night, if we examine it in detail, they really don't have enough breaks during the day. They really don't have They probably haven't had enough sleep the night before. They're not managing their sugar all day long, so maybe they had a good dinner, but during the day was there, you know, whether it was a meal or a snack or something that really kept their glycemic level at a reasonable level. And how many decisions are you making over the course of the day? Because it's not just food decisions that wear down your willpower. Every time you respond to an email, you have to decide, do I report this? Do I respond to it? Do I delegate it? Do I defer it for later? And it burns a little bit of glucose in the brain and your willpower center, and you know, you're that much weaker. So if you can get a couple of extra 5 or 10 minute breaks during the day, even if you just have to go to the bathroom and close the door and get away from people, places and things, and turn off your smartphone and just breathe in the absence of input and demand on your brain power, then that can take the edge off just enough that you start to be able to make those choices at night.
Well, Glenn,
so that's the best I can do in the time we have left.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and that's a great point, and it's one that I never thought of, and I think I'm one of those two that sort of gets worn down. Not necessarily do I deal with it with food, but I just feel like I'm more so getting worn down as the day wears on or we get into the evening as far as making some of the right decisions. Glenn, I just really want to thank you for coming on and for putting the book out again for everybody out there. The book is Never Binge Again. And as you said, you can find it on Kindle or Amazon or most any place where
books are sold. If you go to neverbingeagain.com and click the big red button, you'll get
the book
for free and a bunch of other bonuses.
Wonderful. So again, thank you. And hang on, I'm handing a pen here. I have one more question, for Kelly, and that is that I know that you're part of the upcoming See It, End It Film and Arts Festival in San Pedro. Can you share a little bit of information about that? And for those listening, you can look this up and get more information, or we're going to have one of the organizers, Patrick, will be on next week to tell a little bit more about it as well.
Oh, perfect. Yes, I'm very excited to be a part of this. It's a film and arts festival. That is having, it's to create awareness and a call to action, which is everything that I'm about, but I'm also an artist, an actress and a producer and director. And this See It, End It Human Trafficking Arts Festival is allowing the arts to speak to the people. So I'm so excited about it. I mean, I'm a professor. I teach directing. So it's all it's right up my alley. So it's a film festival, but only on films connected to human or sex trafficking. And the website that you can go to, and I'm very happy Patrick will be on the show next week so you can talk more about it, but is seeitendit.com, all lower case. And please buy your tickets and come. It's on March 29th and 30th. You're going to see incredible films that will, shock you and educate you and, creating awareness and hopefully a call to action. We really are, ordinary people all have to be involved.
I couldn't have said it better. I will be there as well. So please pick up your tickets, plan on being there. Kelly will be there. I'll be there. And I know that there will be some other guests that many of you will probably like to see. So now for next week, please be sure and mark on your calendar. Tune in next Monday when we'll be joined by Sandra Biskind to discuss her new book. I'm sorry. Yes. Codebreaker. Discover the password to unlock the best version of you. You can visit our archives at answersforthefamily.com. You can find the show through iTunes, Stitcher. So for everybody out there, just be good human beings. Be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
God bless.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.